3 days ago, Mr. Crow was murdered. A poker was jammed through his chest, red hot from my observations. Previous, though, it seems he'd managed to get a half a liter of water in his lungs, drowned. Even before that, however, he had already had a fatal encounter with a Brazilian wandering spider, not native to this part of the world, and not found on the scene. Poison was coursing through his veins, but recent reports also point to signs of strangulation from at least a half an hour before... Oh, sorry, pardon. Am I going too fast for you? Let me back up. I've gathered you all here today for the reasoned investigation of atypical analog role-playing. This is the last episode of Parallel Lives, First Edition. Stay tuned after our discussion for news on the future. I'm your host, Bram, and today I am joined by Olivia, Charles, Shannon, and our new guest, Hugh, who has flown in directly from Neverwinter, I believe. We are talking about The Murder of Mr. Crow, which is a game where we all create a murder mystery together. This is by Rickard Eimar, I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, it has
Swedish.
It has two copies of the same vowel with an accent we don't have in English as the end of its name. So we're going to butcher it, and we should just make... Can we just decide on a pronunciation, and we'll just...
We can just call him Rickard. I mean, that's his first name.
Seems awfully familiar.
Rickard, our man, our game.
Our man, Rickard.
Our man, Rickard. Now, I believe this is the second edition. It was put out just this May. It is available from ervikspel.com. That's Clockwork Games in Swedish, if Google Translate leads me right, but the PDF is in English, don't worry. Rickard has also done Imagine, which is a conflict-free storytelling game that is only 4 pages long and is also only 1 hour, much like this one.
The English, despite what you might think, is also very readable. This is not English.
That said, before we get to that, we are briefly going to talk to our new member, Hugh.
Hi.
Hello. Welcome to the Parallel Lives Portland studio.
A pleasure to be here.
In majestic Parallel Lives Tower atop the Parallel Lives cliffs.
The Paraloptican.
I like Paraloptican.
Pleasure to be here. First time, well, not caller, first time guest, long time listener. Long time, I mean like the last month.
It's probably a long time as anyone. He wandered into our labyrinth today, and he has joined us for this game.
I can't escape. They won't let me. They took my string.
Briefly, tell us about your role-playing experience. What you like, what you don't like, what you're here for.
I'm here for whatever. Let's see. What do I like? What do I not like? Well, I've been playing tabletop role-playing games, or rather GMing tabletop role-playing games, since I was like 11, which was arguably a little bit too early to really be able to do it well, but I've had a lot of years of practice to make mistakes and get better at it since then. Played a lot of D20 games, I've played a lot of other things in recent years. Highlights, Dogs in the Vineyard, Fiasco, Apocalypse World, many things, long list. I have it somewhere, but I don't have it with me.
It's actually sort of a murderer's row of games we've all wanted to play.
You may end up doing some repeats, except
that's
for Fiasco,
of
course.
I played a lot of things once, fewer things twice.
So what do you like in those things? What makes these the ones, if you're putting together a favorites list, those are the ones you choose?
I like games that do a good job of having some constructive synergy between their rules and their thematic elements. Games where the author has done a good job of clearly communicating what the premise of the game is, and games where the rules are written in such a way as to make it hard for you to screw up.
I want to keep a particular eye on that last case, because the game we play today may, in my opinion at least, suffer from a bit of a difficulty with that last one.
I think I agree.
Okay.
Let's get into that,
yeah.
He literally showed up today with a copy of Jason Morningstar's Endurance in hand, though, so I think we're in good company. That said, yeah, so The Murder of Mr. Crow is, you may have noticed already that I said it's about an hour long. Sorry, Puppetland is exactly an hour long. And The Murder of Mr. Crow is 2 pages, plus 1 page that can be printed out as additional reference sheets. So you could just have this be one front and one back if you wanted. Puts it in the poor company of Vector. Was that 3 pages? I don't remember. Whatever the case, it's better than Vector, I promise you that.
But in the better company of Tower of Hats.
And frankly, for a game that's only 2 pages, it does a pretty good job of telling you how to play.
Yeah, I don't think it's missing. I mean, we've already hinted that I think part of the difficulty is a vagueness in the rules, but I don't think that it missed much that was necessary to us to play it.
Right.
I think what it fell short on is what you maybe need to tell people in order to play it well.
Right.
This is the only game that we've ever played where we looked at it, tried to play it, and were like, oh, if only we had a prescribed list of objects that we had to choose from necessarily. That would help us so much.
The structure of the rules is approximately a three-act system. There is a first act in which you are setting up characters and pieces of evidence that matter to your mystery. A second phase in which the detective questions suspects, and a third and final phase in which party comes together and constructs a narrative of what exactly happened. Without any further ado, let's talk phase one. It's a pretty simple version of this kind of thing. You go around the table and everyone assembles a character, and that process is you give them a title, you give them a name, and all of the example names are names of animal species, and the rules do suggest that you stick with animal species, which is cool and flavorful and lends the proceedings a Clue-like vibe, because, you know, we ended up with Dame Axolotl and Mr. Weasel and Dr. Polecat and Friend Badger. And you give them...
How could you butcher the badger? You love the badger.
I love the badger. The badger is my favorite. You give them a name, and you give them a profession, and you're done. And that's round one around the table. Second time around the table, everyone is writing down either a small object or something heard or noticed that will be linked up with the suspects later.
As we continue, it may become clear that, at least in my opinion, this game is sort of a strange murder mystery cross between A Penny for My Thoughts and Fiasco.
These detail objects are harder than they seem, and I think this is where we all were wishing, at least I was, that there was a list of suggested items. Because picking good details cold is hard.
Much harder than I expected, because we all arrive with the way that people do, a passing familiarity with the parlor mystery genre, which is really the specific mystery subgenre we're working in. Like, the detective has called everyone together, the murderer is in the room, and by golly, he's going to ask some pointed questions and then explain who the murderer in fact is. And so you have a passing familiarity with the kind of clues that appear in these sorts of narratives. But it turns out if you just go around the table and be like, a statue, a letter, some parking receipts, those won't hang together as well as you might expect.
At least not without some significant and deliberate weaving, and that can be a little bit hard on the fly. Especially because this is, as you've probably already grasped, a GM-less game, so everybody has creative control at some times.
Also, we should probably interject here, before we get too much further along, that this review is exactly 200% more informed than the average review you receive on this podcast. Because we did not play this game once, we played it twice. Because it is, in fact, an hour long like it expects to be, even for people who are playing it the first time through, which is a pretty cool selling point.
I think it took about an hour and 10 minutes the first time, and an hour and 5 minutes the second time I was timing it.
Oh, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. And that sort of, I think actually that compactness in storytelling has been thus far a rarity. Like, a lot of games can aim towards an hour, but in fact end up like 2.5. Lord knows, I think we had that problem nearly kill us towards the end of Penny for My Thoughts, Your Thoughts, The Thoughts, Some Thoughts.
And despite the compactness, I think it achieves a reasonable level of detail and richness, strong play experience, that I've played games of Fiasco that didn't have.
The three acts it opts for, I mean, the first one's a slightly flavorless, like, setting up time, but I think it hits the two biggest story beats that you want to see in a parlor mystery, which is, like, pointed detective question time, and, like, well, here is how it all happened. And I think it found the right, it starts as close to the end of the story as you can, which is, I hear, a thing that you should try and do in story writing.
I was going to say, actually, while I was reading through the rules, especially, I was looking at this and thinking, oh, okay, so it's a murder mystery game in which you cut out the entire part of the story where you have to read through or watch through and see people acting suspicious for a while, and you get it right to the parlor scene, which seemed like a good idea to me.
So phase two begins when somebody puts on a hat. The person who puts on the hat becomes suddenly...
As with most of my plans, phase two is hats. Phase three is also hats. Phases 2 through 6 are hats.
Charles, Tower of Hats. That's Tower of Hats. Stop talking about Tower of Hats. Phase two begins when somebody puts on a hat. The person who puts on the hat becomes a detective. The next step in phase two is the detective points at somebody, addresses them as the name of a character, whatever character they choose, and asks them a question related, ideally, to one of the things that is already on the page. At first, this is going to be one of your items. You know, if you've written down £1,000,000 in bearer bonds or a love letter, you would ask the person about one of those things. That person essentially rolls to see if they're a cooperative witness or an incooperative witness. Now, on the page, these two things differ significantly. A cooperative witness agrees with everything that the detective says and may add some extra helpful details for the detective. An incooperative witness agrees with everything that the detective says, but may muddy the waters by involving other suspects or answering evasively. In practice, we found these to be fairly challenging to make significantly different. It's hard enough to come up with responses on the fly and yes and the detective, while also, it's hard enough to do that in the first place without also muddying the waters.
And particularly because in the case where you're a cooperative witness and the detective is asking you questions like, so you definitely stole like a bunch of money from the deceased, right? And you can't say like, why would you say such a thing of me? As a cooperative witness, your response has to begin basically like, well, apparently I did. I learned that here now. It's a little hard to play a character who's going along with those questions while also trying to play a character who's maintaining their own innocence like anyone would in this situation. Because there isn't a person who starts out canonically guilty. So you have to be someone who agrees to all the accusations but still says, like, well, it's, you know, there are mitigating factors.
Charles, I don't think you've watched enough episodes of Law & Order.
I think that's probably true.
Speaking as someone who's watched hundreds of episodes of Law & Order.
Oh, boy.
I can tell you that it's fairly standard for all of the red herring suspects to eventually admit that they're guilty of other different crimes.
Yeah, I was fucking his wife, but it didn't mean I killed him.
Exactly.
Oh, fair enough. It's possible. Yeah, I may not have been trying to target that character well enough. Is this the second point at which vagueness in the rules comes up? Because knowing that that's an option, I think probably makes your roleplay as a cooperative witness a lot easier. And I, not knowing that, in my first cross-examination, I instantly became a blood cultist. I started out knowing I was a student, and in the next 30 seconds, I was into blood rituals. And I was just like, yeah, uh-huh, blood rituals, definitely a thing I was doing, super into blood rituals, man, they're great. And it was a little hard to be like, and also I'm innocent somehow? But no, you're right, like, you just have to be like, well, yeah, I committed the crime you're alleging, but not the murder. And this is not a thing that exists on the page, so you have to know it or learn it.
Yeah, we played this game twice, and the reason that we did that is that the first time we played it, we weren't super satisfied with what happened. The second time, we sort of went in really thinking hard about this being a murder mystery, and really thinking hard about weaving in murder tropes, mixing things together, and, you know, having this big, elaborate, interwoven thing that, again, followed tropes. So if you don't know anything about murder mysteries, this game is going to be a lot more challenging. And if you're not bearing that in mind, it's, again, going to be a lot more challenging.
I think we could have even taken this a step further. What we didn't do in the second game, except implicitly, was pick a definite setting. I think this game could benefit a lot if, before creating characters, you pick city and a year.
Yeah, no, a city, a year, a tone, a vague time period, what level of serious versus goofy mystery we're doing. Again, like, all of us found ourselves recalling Fiasco, and Fiasco's use of playsets to set tone and setting. And that's restriction, in a way, but as someone said, sometime restriction, something, something, creativity.
While this didn't happen in our game, there was absolutely nothing stopping from a witness being like, oh yes, that happened on my way back from the Martian colonies, which I think people probably have the good sense not to do, but you never know.
I think the vast majority of role-playing games manage to make it through their lives without ever stipulating that you're not allowed to suddenly introduce sci-fi in your backstory, and I feel like it's okay to trust players with that here.
By the way, Charles, it is restriction hats creativity.
Oh, fair enough. I think that is it.
That said, this game only takes an hour, and so introducing wild card elements that completely screw everything up isn't going to ruin everyone's evening. Because if it leads to an unsatisfying game, you can just try again.
Yeah, in a way similar to Wacky Dread, I feel like you could kind of go as far off the wall as you wanted, and as long as you're keeping to the time limit, I think there's a lower bound on how bad a time you can have.
Which is a pretty remarkable feat of game design, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. But no, it definitely, like, there was a moment when, like, Bram was the final person to choose, like, the clue object, and she was just sitting there looking at it and being like, but I could choose a time machine. And we were like, man, who don't do it?
I had the good sense, but somewhere lurking in the back of my mind is a monster. A monster that loves time machines.
A monster that loves time machines and Sonic the Hedgehog.
That second part is slander.
Our first game had an albatross around its neck, and that albatross was shaped like a furry blue hedgehog.
Look, if all your characters are named Mr. or Miss or whatever character name, sometimes it might be a funny joke to name them Mr. Hedgehog.
And to make him a professional runner.
And to make me a professional racer. I regretted this decision quickly.
For the record, not only was Mr. Hedgehog innocent of the crime he was accused of, but in fact, we all felt so bad for how viciously we had mocked him that nobody even accused him in the end.
Which is probably an okay transition point, yeah?
Yeah!
Let's talk about accusation and the way that works in this game. When there's like a mystery system in a game, I'm pretty used to seeing a struggle for how you determine guilt. If mystery is part of your game, how do you determine guilt? Has everyone else here played Android?
Yes.
All right. We're one maybe? Short.
Yes, you no, played
yeah,
Android.
Yeah, I played it.
I played it with you.
Oh, yeah, I was a detective.
I was just asking, Bram, how is Android?
It's, oh man, it sure is sprawling.
A game. My answer was a long, guttural sound that was not a word.
You love Android.
But I can't say it's good.
Android is just about the most game you can cram into a box and call a single board game. There are like 5 interlocking systems. Each character has different systems by which they play their special character cards. There's a crime to solve and a conspiracy about the crime. And so there's a conspiracy puzzle board that's basically a like pipe puzzle, and a crime board, which is a secret like leaderboard.
And there are personal goals for your character to accomplish or fail at.
Because each character has a narrative story that they're telling, and things can resolve good or badly in their Act 1 or Act 2 subplots. Android is an absolute mutant of a game.
In the same way that we did talk briefly for one mini-episode about the Tales of the Arabian Nights, I was actually considering doing an Android episode, but that would require playing another game of Android,
yeah.
I think.
I was noticing that.
Which is like a day of your life.
It does take a minimum of 3 hours if you already know how to play.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really? I mean, I thought six minimum. Oh. Three.
No, we Bram and I think played some sort of hyper marathon game at some point in college. We were just like, all right, we all know how to play this game, we're gonna do it. All right, ready, set, Android.
But what I wanted to point to briefly was there is a mystery section in Android where there is a murder at the start of the game, and fundamentally the game's about solving it and like dealing with your trauma from the war. If you're the particular character whose subplot is dealing with your trauma from the war, try Android. Don't pay for it, but find a way to play it at like your local game store. It's actually an experience. But the way that the system of determining guilt in that game works is players wander around town going to places where the clues are located, and then when they pick up the clues, they get an evidence token, and they say, all right, this evidence definitely points to like the hotshot DJ and hacker like Maze Racker.
Nice.
And Noise, excuse me, the hacker's name is Noise. And that doesn't feel like solving a mystery. That feels like planting evidence. And at the end of the game, whoever had the most evidence that pointed to them that people put there because they had a hunch that pointed towards Noise, that's the person who is apparently validly guilty. It's hard to do this, like, how do you figure out guilt? And the murder of Mr. Crow comes up with its own method.
Yeah. Well, I personally don't have too much problem with the flavor of the solving the mystery in Android. I just wanted to note briefly, if there's anyone out there who just has a weird niggling sensation in the back of their head and they're trying to think of Android but they can't remember where they know it from, Android is an earlier game where the setting for Android Netrunner, a popular game that is pretty good, people would say to you, I'm actually super bad at it. That's where that setting comes from. So if you've heard of Noise, if you play Noise, and you don't know what we're talking about, it's from Android Senior.
Crow comes up with its own solution for how to determine guilt in a mystery game. Basically, what happens is questioning continues until a plausible motive has been established for each of the suspects. And at that point, it is time to move to the phase that the game calls the revelation, where everyone throws some stuff in a hat. Probably still the detective hat? The way that the revelation phase works is that each player writes their name and the name of their chosen guilty suspect on a card. Those cards are put into a hat. Players then take turns drawing those cards out of the hat. The player whose card is drawn explains the narrative of the crime such that they plausibly establish how that person could be the killer. The following person, without directly contradicting the people preceding them, presents the case for the crime as committed by their person, until we get down to two cards left, and we pick the second to last card, and the player who draws that card explains the whole crime and establishes, finally, who really done did it.
Something that is really charming and really fun, at least potentially, especially if you're good at it, about the fact that you basically build the actual murder scenario up until you reach the person who actually did it, is that it allows for all kinds of really ridiculous murder tropes, like, yes, Sir Polecat did stab Mr. Crow, but he was already dead, you know, stuff like that.
He'd been poisoned at the time, I think, was ours.
Yes.
One of the things that I like weirdly about this game is that in part of its rules, it has a diagram of a hat going on a person's head, a diagram of a hat, I guess, being passed around there, and then it has a diagram of the hat being turned upside down and you putting notes in it. So if there's any confusion about a hat's work, we've got you covered. Thanks, Rickard.
For the record, our confusion about the rules was not related to the direction of hats or placing thereof.
There was some confusion about whether you needed two hats, which only became clear on a close reading of the rules.
Fortunately, we had two.
No, we had a surfeit of hats.
Three, actually.
A veritable tower.
An embarrassment of hats.
And this phase, I think, also, on its surface, has a pretty good structure to produce that final great scene in which the detective lays it all out and how this baroque set of circumstances resulted in a murder where somehow all five of these people look like valid suspects and indeed all probably committed some crime or other. But in the end, it was this one goat dude. This dude. What am I saying?
Yeah, Mr. Dude.
Mr. Dude. No. Dr. Dude.
It's worth noting that a lot of this flexibility comes from the fact that in both of our games, we didn't exactly specify how the murder occurred in Acts 1 or 2 or in outside of game conversations preceding the third act. And so when we played out the third act, there was a lot of freedom to have five different means of death all at play.
Yeah, and I think you and I end up differing slightly on whether that was a boon to the third act or whether that meant that we'd been misplaying in Act 2.
Right, and I came down on the side that was a boon to the third act, whereas you disagreed.
Yeah, my thought was approximately that going into the third act, we had mostly spent time establishing motive, because that's the only explicit goal, is to have a motive and a connection to all the pieces of evidence. But we often did that in a way where it ended up being that we didn't specify much about the murder. We talked about their relationships, we talked about the money that was stood to change hands, and, like, how was Mr. Crow deaded? What did we unto him do to dead? Maybe he fell. I don't know.
I disagree a little bit in that we implicitly established the time of day of the murder and the scene of the crime, and we, in both games, we established multiple people who were seen at that place and time, and therefore needed to be worked into the narrative of the crime.
Yeah. I think in the first game we established more, I think, than we ended up with in the second. And I think there was enough of a framework in the first game where, again, we'd have a day and a time, and we had at least one person placed at the scene positively. And at least one person placed at the scene, maybe, but the witness was unreliable. And I think that helped out.
How do people feel that this final act performed in either game? Because I feel actually kind of negative about it. I think in a perfectly played, perfectly designed game of The Murder of Mr. Crow, you would end it, and the final topping off point would be a very satisfying parlor room scene where you explain all the different various possible ways that he could have been murdered and how they interacted with each other. And it felt like satisfying and good and like a thing that could have happened. And ours were like, oh, well, he got stabbed, but maybe he also got poisoned.
I certainly found this final act very, very challenging. If you're the person who gets to go first, it's probably not that challenging for you, and you just get to lay out whatever thing you like and whatever thing seems cool and fun to you. But if you're any person after that and you have to start actually weaving other people's ideas in, again, I think it's a lot more challenging. And I don't know, it's hard because I do think that we weren't great at it, but I also think that, you know, it's sort of a game in which, in order to have a very satisfying ending, you have to be good at it. And it doesn't provide you that much help to be good at it. And that's not the best situation that there is.
I think this final act revelation is one part of the game that's particularly sensitive to how familiar you are with the tropes of the genre, or particularly how familiar you are with the incredibly convoluted plots that characterize the kind of murder mystery that is resolved in a parlor scene, really as epitomized and parodied in Clue.
I agree. I'm sorry that Bram didn't find the compelling, but I agree with you, Hugh. I think that this is one of the parts where the rules did a really good job of causing players to generate the parlor scene in that baroque and kind of silly fashion where, like, yeah, you know, you do have... I think in both games we had, like, character A is on the way to commit the murder, but B preempts them, like, just got there first, and, like, I always love that as a dumb tropey plot. And if you have to construct a narrative of the murder that starts with one person saying, like, well, if this person did it, here's how they did it, and the next person has to not contradict that while saying, like, well, here's how my guy did it instead, you get those plots really easily out of these rules.
I think that is definitely true. But the other thing that I think is that it doesn't necessarily feel good in the moment. What it can feel a little bit more like, at least for me in my experience, is really slapdash and really ridiculous. And really like, oh shoot, oh, how do I get it? Both of the doors are occupied and I have to get like this third person in there. Where are they? Are they hiding in the chair? Are they in the ceiling? Can I think of any other Edgar Allan Poe things that I can steal? Etc., etc.
That is a joke for almost no one.
It's a joke for me!
Yeah, no, I'm glad you got that one in there, but
thanks.
That is for almost nobody.
Whatever, he's a great murder mystery writer. So you have to just, like, really, really struggle to find a thing that seems good, and it maybe doesn't feel great in the moment. It feels really slapdash, really silly, doesn't piece together very well, isn't satisfying.
Like, I really like the idea of, like, oh, you have to build on each previous person's explanation of how this happened. It's like an increasingly complicated murder. I find it, A, kind of difficult, which doesn't make necessarily for a great experience if you're sitting there trying to think of something in, like, 3 minutes of silence, or if you're sitting there with someone else trying to think of something in 3 minutes of silence. And B, it's complicated by the fact that, like, if you do know how Mr. Crow died ahead of time, then you have to make sure you know, like, okay, he did get stabbed somehow, and that has to be worked in there by one or multiple characters, I don't know. Or if you don't know how he died, can you suddenly be like, I guess he did get stabbed, but after they left, a wrecking ball came in and smashed the whole house, and he was crushed underneath it.
I do suspect, actually, that not specifying method of death in Phase 2 probably makes Phase 3 a lot more doable, and I think, at least on that point, I think remaining vague was right.
I agree.
So, I think this was going to come up eventually, but, or at least I was going to bring it up eventually, but because the rules for this game are only 2 pages, there's less explanation and less in the way of examples than there would be if this was, say, a 20-page game. And because of that, the way that the revelation phase played out is very much subject to our interpretation of 2 sentences. And so if you, reading the rules, understand those sentences differently than we do, you might find that some of these limits are less present in your experience, or that it's even harder than we're saying. I really wish that this game had an example of play.
Yeah,
like
I agree completely.
Many
I definitely
other
have that
rules do. And that would make how you're supposed to play out the revelation phase a lot clearer.
I think you can go ahead and read those 2 sentences if you think that they are good and illustrative. I think they're 2 sentences. I don't think it's a big deal.
Here is literally all you know about how to play the revelation phase.
Correction, it's 4 sentences, but the last to finish shakes the hat, draws a note, and calls out both names. The author of the note will describe how and why the chosen suspect could have killed Mr. Crow. New information may be added to this explanation. Continue drawing names and adding theories and explanations, taking the previous ones into account. If the same suspect appears more than once during the draw, it's also allowed to describe how another suspect helped out.
I remember while you were talking about that, during the first game that we played, we ran into the situation where we had drawn through several different suspects and narrated how they might have done it, and it happened to be the case that the penultimate suspect was Miss Weasel. And then we drew it, and we had my suspect, so I had to narrate how it could have happened, and it turns out my suspect was also Miss Weasel. So we're left with a moment where we're like, well, I don't have to say anything, I guess? I guess we're done. And so, like the rules say you may add an additional...
Accomplice.
Accomplice. But it didn't feel like necessary or valuable or fun.
Yeah, no, if someone has just explained how Miss Weasel could have done it, and I draw one that says, like, well, I decided that Miss Weasel did it, what do I add to that exactly? I guess an accomplice if I feel like it, but it doesn't have much of a sense of urgency to it. It feels like, do you want to, like, retell that story I just told? Because you can, I guess.
And she bought the poison from Captain Rhino.
Yeah.
So this may be a bit of an aside at this point, but one of the other consequences of the brevity of this rules write-up is that it's unclear whether suspects should be associated with specific players. For the most part, we always have the same person play the same suspects, but at least in the second game, I ended up at different points playing three different characters, and I think two in the first game. This may or may not come naturally to your playgroup, and people may or may not like playing multiple characters.
It's good that you brought that up, because I think the vast majority of our criticism of this game takes the form of something like this vagueness in the rules, or what went unsaid and could perhaps have been made more explicit, is where the thing fell down for us. And I think that one where it's not clear that any player is any suspect in the way that, you know, Joe is playing Llewellyn the Bard, I think that was a vagueness that did not harm our game. And would probably only be harmful if people are, like, interested in getting attached to and into the head of their character, and then someone else plays them as a doofus.
I think that's an issue that's actually really tricky in storytelling games in general. There's some problems with that in Durance, which, well, hopefully we'll talk about in a later podcast. And I've encountered in other games where there are perhaps more characters than there are players. It becomes hard to keep the game going nicely if one player is very attached to their specific character, but other players aren't. And you sort of need to get everyone on the same page about whether there's going to be a one-to-one assignment of players to characters or not.
This wasn't something that we encountered during our play of this game. For those of you who remember our review of The Quiet Year, though, I believe that did happen there. And, you know, in that same kind of way, I could see it happening here. Although I do believe in a game where you're going in with the intent of one of these characters could be a murderer, I don't know if you're going to be as attached.
Yeah, another difference between this game and a lot of games is that you do get to create a character in the sense that you name them and you give them a profession. But after that, which character you take the interrogation of is random. The detective will just point at you and be like, all right, you're Duke Greyhound, talk to me. So it's a little bit harder to get attached to a character that you didn't necessarily create.
And let's look back to that assignation of guilt thing. If you've been, you know, listening ever so carefully to our dulcet tones, you'll notice that the way that guilt is ultimately assigned is, lol, random. It's not that everyone agrees that, you know, Duke Greyhound did it. And if more people say Duke Greyhound is the person, then that's the way that the mystery ends up resolving.
Except statistically.
No, fair enough, except statistically it is likely that Duke Greyhound did it if everyone puts in Duke Greyhound.
Which, for one, I think is a really clever choice.
Ah, you like that one. Okay. I guess I don't know what I'm looking for, because, yeah, to assign guilt in any other way would require grafting some kind of, like, conflict resolution system or a, like, guilt probability system into this that is honestly probably more complex than this game wants.
I'd also note that the rules require that you have assigned a plausible motive for murder to every character, and if you've done your job, there should at least be a believable narrative by which any one of the characters commits the murder, which is totally the trope of this kind of parlor scene.
Yeah, but if say, there is a character who is clearly pulled ahead as the most interesting case for the murder, or the one with the motive that seems the most fun to play out or to work through, if you want to play it out like they done did it, I sure hope your drawing luck from the hat is behind you.
In a perfect world, however, the story wins.
I'm not quite sure what you mean.
In a perfect world, we assign these motives, we weave this interleaved plot, and then at the end of the day, we all look back and we go, what was the coolest? And in a perfect world, we all decide, like, oh, having Sir Polecat be the murderer was the coolest. Let's all vote for Sir Polecat. And indeed, that's what happens.
Mm-hmm.
I think this gets at something that's, again, a problem in storytelling games like this, where there can be a bit of a conflict between the provided formula for how you set up the story and the suggestions of what tropes are at play, and what your playgroup actually ends up coming up with over the course of playing out many scenes and building up a narrative. Because sometimes you just end up with a story that's not really quite what you started out with.
Are we talking about sort of a genre drift between what perhaps the designer was thinking of and what your playgroup ends up building, or is it something a little different?
I think that's a good way of putting it. This seems very much geared for a kind of story where when you finish, it's a confused mess and you don't know who's guilty, really, and it's an equally satisfying resolution for it to be more or less anyone. This game includes a nice mechanic by which if you all put the same character into the hat, it's going to be that character, and there's no ambiguity about it, but other reasonably similar games don't necessarily provide a mechanic like that. Mm-hmm. So I actually think that's something that this game does very well.
On the other hand, if a bunch of you disagree, you may be stuck with like your cohort's stupid ass answers.
That's more of a problem of who you're playing with, though.
No,
right?
Sure, but like it's potentially a problem that you could run into. Again, this game is only an hour long, so I don't think. At the end of the day, if anybody is devastated, I'm shocked.
It's hard to feel too much animus towards a game that said 1 hour, kept to its promise, and delivered an experience that was approximately in the genre it intended,
yeah,
with two pages of rules. Like, that's such an achievement of, like, brevity and compression that I just go like, eh.
I'm likely to seem unduly critical about anything, but this was really quite a fun game. I've played it twice now, and I'd play it at least twice more.
Yeah. We should talk about, actually, I don't know if this, we shouldn't promote it to a segment on the show exactly, but especially as we play as many storytelling games as we do, a big problem in role-playing gaming is that there is a real way in which the games are only as good as your friends are. And we talked in particular on the Fiasco cast about how really it feels like this game is only as good, it's only as fun as your friends are witty. And I know that even Hugh specifically had talked about his experiences playing Fiasco in the past and having just some real clunkers of games.
Fiascos?
Yeah. When you're playing Fiasco with people who are not great at improvisational acting or get really fixated on their character and really want their characters to succeed, Fiasco is a recipe for hurt feelings, interpersonal tension, and lasting damage to your friendships.
Wow. That wasn't our experience, was it?
No, we had a good time.
All of us are still in the room.
Yeah.
Briefly, Charles, why do you call it the Fiasco cast and not the Ficasto?
Because it's awful. Because that's awful. The thing you just said is an awful word. And in the black tongue, never speak it again in my
life. I will go to my death for Ficasto, Charles.
Yeah, I know, the Ficasto.
For the record, I'm excited to have you here telling us that we were right about Fiasco. I believe that one of the things that we say is this might not be for you if you're really hooked on your own character and their successes.
This experiment has been replicated. We have independent confirmation.
When
field researcher Hugh.
Yeah.
So we should establish. Well, let's do like a 1 to 10 scale. Where how dependent is a game on your friends being good, witty, genre aware, and able to like improv in a specific mode on the fly?
Those are all separate questions.
That's a cluster of skills that are often related. Is that crazy?
No, that's not crazy. I don't think.
I don't think it's crazy, but I think at least some of those you can have without having the others. I've played games with players who are genre-aware, creative, and witty, but cannot play a character in the first person to save their lives.
Oh, interesting. Fair enough. The simplified version is probably the how witty do your friends need to be for this game to be good scale. Is our maximum Fiasco, or is there one that we would put above that?
I think there's a hypothetical other game that's worse than Fiasco at that.
Probably there's a hypothetical one, but in terms of real ones that I've encountered, Fiasco's the winner.
And what is the one that is least dependent on your friends being, like, witty and quick on their feet?
That we've played?
Dungeons & Dragons 4th edition.
D&D 4E, probably. Oh, Neon Saint. I guess, yeah,
we've
Warhammer.
Implicitly raised
Warhammer
40K. Yeah.
But,
there's sort of a question of whether the other non-role-playing components of the game are fun enough by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that can save a game even when your friends are idiots.
I want to make sure that we don't end up with the low end of the scale being like, well, this is a game to play if you're dumb. Because I think there are plenty of good games that are not dependent on that, and possibly even good role-playing games,
right.
So I have a harder time thinking of them.
We love Neon Sanctum.
Yeah.
We should probably focus this question on storytelling games and GM-less systems. This is, I think, a much, much less useful question in mechanically heavy systems in the first place, and in the second place, it causes our scale to be bizarre if we include them.
All right, but at the risk of taking this into storytelling versus mechanics territory, can anyone come up with a storytelling game that works if your friends are not witty?
I don't think there are any that work great, but I was going to propose, actually, Ribbon Drive as possibly a good low ebb. because that is a game where you have a constantly running soundtrack that you have to riff off of in the background, and that's just a decent back-channel thing to have going. In this game, when you don't know how to take your line of questioning, it's you and silence or asking for an assistant, which is a mechanic that we haven't mentioned at all and we should mention briefly.
Oh, yeah, fair enough.
Someone want to talk about assistants?
It's really easy. Basically, cool. If the detective is having trouble thinking of good questions to ask, they can call for an assistant and they say, "Assistant, help me with this." And the assistant says, "Well, do you like option X or do you like option Y?" And the detective chooses between those. The assistant can call for an assistant as well.
We didn't use it very much, but it seems helpful. I was going to say real quick, though, I don't know if it would be a 1 to 10 scale for the thing you're thinking, honestly. Certainly, I think for all storytelling games, at least all the ones that I've encountered, having a group of role players that are, you know, at least somewhat witty, at least somewhat good on their feet for improvising and role-playing is important. I'm just not sure if there's actually a big enough division between the different games that I have played, at least, that I'd be able to say, like, oh yeah, Ribbon Drive's a 2 and Fiasco is a 7. Like, it feels like, yeah, okay, this is a 1 to 3 scale or something.
The experience has been slightly night and day-like for me sometimes. I don't think we're ever the world's worst role players. We're certainly never going to be the best, but there were definitely some games where, you know, bad plots dragged the game down more versus less. An inability to come up with a cool or interesting thing for your character or the group to be doing on the fly mattered more or mattered less. 1 to 10 is obviously an arbitrary set of gradations, and I think I understand the central meaning when you say, like, it might be 1 to 3. Like, it might not range that widely.
I feel like if you're going to ask me to put, like, all the storytelling games I've ever played on this list, I'm like, well, they're all really close together. Like, they'd all be about the same thing. Like, I'm not saying they're all the same. Their mechanics vary widely, but honestly, it just feels like you have to know your group. Yeah.
I think this is a question that could be interesting to revisit if and hopefully when we play Durance, because I think the comparison between Durance and Fiasco will get directly at some of these questions.
I'm super interested in that. I'm super interested. All this is a very long-winded way of asking the question, how dependent on friend group wittiness do you think The Murder of Mr. Crow is? I would tend towards high, myself.
Ooh, interesting.
Yeah.
Hugh, you first.
I would say low, because the premise of the game gives you enough structure that I think for many players it might be easier to answer direct questions than just start acting. All of this game requires is that you be able to come up with an answer to a question that's posed to you directly and in character, not use a question as a meditative touchstone on which you center a scene that somehow reveals some portion of your soul, la-di-da.
You can tell Hugh has listened to our archives.
I think two things about this. I think that any given interaction between two players is going to be fairly limited. A detective is going to ask 3 questions. A suspect is going to answer 3 questions. If you have 2 horrible players in that seat, their interaction is not going to last that long. If you have 2 strong players, it's not going to last that long, but it's probably going to be good. If you have a strong player and a weak player, the strong player can help the weak player out. And I think that that is super valuable. Where this breaks down is in Act 3. Act 3, as we have already discussed, some of us found very challenging in the first place, and I think could be extremely challenging for players that have more trouble, and nobody is there to help them out. Who knows not only if a weak player is going to be chosen, but also how many weak players in a row are going to be chosen to give their spiels in Act 3. Hugh was first, I think.
This might be too much of a technical note to be worth including, but one interesting aspect of the back-and-forth interrogation system is it actually allows either player to carry the weight of adding new content to the story. The detective, at least by our reading of the rules, is allowed to ask very loaded questions that include a lot of background. If you were very strict about requiring that the detective only ask one-sentence questions or only ask a specific kind of question, a lot more of the work would be left to the player playing the suspect. As it is, both players can do quite a lot, and that led to, I think, more natural and better role-playing than other storytelling games that prompt you into a similar situation.
That's fair. Actually, I'm probably underrating the way in which the back and forth question system through Act Two gives you a lot of leeway to carry one another at moments when it's weak. I just know that, like, I felt myself being like, all right, so I have to question someone. I have to come up with what I'm questioning them about. And I may know almost nothing about them except their profession. And from that, I have to begin constructing a murder plot. A murder plot that terminates in a clear motive for them. And while I'm finding a murder plot that terminates in a clear motive for them, I'm also going to have to incorporate one of our pieces of evidence, or at least I'm going to have to try. And I think that's a pretty high order. I felt the weight upon myself when I was the person in the detective seat, and I suspect that people weaker at that sort of thought on the fly would also feel that weight. Or, you know, as weak as I.
Having said that, in a third iteration of this game, I would do better, because I think that it's really difficult to, as you're first starting to play, on the fly, have sort of the big picture in mind, have it in mind that you were trying to create this interesting, convoluted murder mystery. But as you continue playing, or if you just already know the tropes and are already quite good, I think you can sort of keep your eyes on the prize in that way. And so, again, as the detective, you can do your best to basically do what Charles was saying and figure out how to aim at a solid motive, how to aim at these connections. But you can also do that as the suspect, because this is not in any way a competitive game. You know, this is a game where your allegiance as the player ultimately probably should be to the story. So you don't have to necessarily, as the detective, be the only one bearing the weight of pushing us towards a satisfying motive, of making those connections. As the suspect, you can help out too.
I think it's easy to fall to the initial impulse in playing the suspect to strive to prove your innocence. And I think it's easy to end up putting that innocence, and indeed in that way that can sink fiasco games, your character's success ahead of the success of the narrative. And I think that pitfall exists here too. So it's easy for the suspect to not take up that weight, because there feels, even though there's no winner and there's no loser, you're not going for a good or a bad end, it's not competitive the way that fiasco is, I think there is a plausible reason that people might tend to behave that way.
That does make sense.
See, I think I approach playing one of the suspects in sort of completely the opposite way as Charles, in that regardless of whether I was supposed to be a hostile or friendly witness, I inserted a lot of details that made the suspect I was playing look guilty of something, at least, because I was trying to put as much new information into the story as possible.
I will pause only to clarify that I neither support nor think that I ended up always playing my suspects that way. I just think there's a pitfall there that it's easy to start out from, and I know that when I was first questioned, I ended up there, and only later was like, wait a second, I think this probably worsens the game if you do it this way. Do we have enough to talk about a prime?
Is there anything further to be said on, like, wacky murder of Mr. Whoa?
I have a bunch of serious prime suggestions.
I think serious prime suggestions are completely
allowed. Mr. Crow, extended edition, Long War.
Yes, actually.
Long War.
I think one of the weaknesses of this going into the revelation might actually be that in the name of brevity, we tended to get directly to motives for each character right away. Mm-hmm. And so our estimate that, yeah, it really does take an hour, presumes that all of the interrogation more or less goes to motive, because that's what's needed to move on to the next phase of the game. Mm-hmm. If instead you avoided, or at least didn't decide immediately on a motive right away, and asked, I would say, two or three times as many questions as we did, and came up with a much more complicated plot, there's a version of this game that you could play in maybe 2.5 hours that would be, I think, really interesting. Keeping track of all the details would be a lot harder.
Yeah, that was the thing I was going to say. Is like, I like it, but we managed, especially the second time around, to end up with a plot complicated enough that going into Revelation, we turned to each other and were like, so, does anyone know what's happening here? And as one we agreed, we were like, I know some of it.
Yeah, there were multiple forged wills flying around, I think. I don't know.
We had...
It wasn't that complicated, guys.
We had up to 3 forged wills. Possibly.
You can't be the person who says, it wasn't that complicated, guys, because you were the one who introduced all those forged wills.
Well, yes, but...
Now, for this version, would you call that either the murder of Mr. Crow, or that you have another name for it?
I believe what you're looking for is the murder of Crow.
You're right. That was just hiding in my heart, and I did not know it.
Or a murder of crows?
A murder of Mr. Crows.
The Murders of Mr. Crow?
Okay, that's getting, like, multiverse. Which I think is maybe allowed, but I don't have good ideas for it.
That would be the other alternate version of the game that I'd suggest.
Oh, good.
Fully embrace bizarre science fiction elements. Choose a time machine as your first item.
I mean, honestly,
I think it would work just fine.
It would be a much sillier game, and maybe not a better one for it, but if in the revelation you'd be like, well, all that happened, yes, but that wasn't Mr. Crow who died there, that was his clone. Had he died in another dimension? And so on. But I think from there you're going, you know, out from this, not grounded exactly, but at least relatively straightforward storytelling game to something where it is just you trying to make the wackiest stories possible.
Another reasonably straightforward version 2.0, or Prime, I guess it's Prime in the local dialect.
Yeah.
It's what you crazy kids call it.
That's what Charles calls it.
Charles is a crazy kid.
Would be to drop the animal names, pick a specific setting, and agree beforehand about location and nature of the crime and things like that. I think that's a substantive set of changes to the basics of the game that would lead to a probably more focused play experience.
Let's talk about soap operas. As with A Penny for My Thoughts, I look at this and I think to myself, okay, what other scenario could we be dancing around? Does it have to be a murder? Or could it be, you know, like the father of a child? Could it be, you know, who's under that wedding veil at this marriage that we're all attending? It could be all kinds of things. And this is obviously sort of scattershot. But, like, I don't think it has to be a murder. I think you could, especially if you have sort of a romance novel or soap opera mindset, I think you could make this all kinds of things.
You're all playing Lois Lane trying to figure out Superman's secret identity.
Yes!
At a bare minimum, serious suggestion, again, I think this is a pretty good Reservoir Dogs generator. I think if you want to play Reservoir Dogs, and not just, like, I admit, like, highly themed names put me in mind of that, but I think there's that central, like, something's gone wrong, someone's to blame, everyone has the look of guilt about them. I think if you want to have those sorts of scenes, I think it's pretty easy to do that. And in fact, my actual thought on this is, I bet you can graft this system wholly and entirely into other campaigns.
Absolutely.
I think you can transpose a game of The Murder of Mr. Crow into the middle of your almost anything campaign. Because all you have is basically a party and a mystery and a set of rules that won't interact poorly with any other rules you may be using.
The only thing with that is you will have players switching between them who is the detective at any given time, which I'm not sure works as well.
Yeah, I think if the detective just becomes the GM,
I mean, that's playing an NPC. Right, yeah.
Or, you know, you're in a setting in which the AI detective personality hops between the cyber brains of a party in our near future hellscape. Look, I like it conceptually, but I freely admit that keeping that part of the system intact.
Do you want to graph this to Monster Hearts?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, that's literally what I was thinking, but I didn't say it because I got briefly sidetracked by thinking about our previous Monster Hearts graft and thinking about, like, shoving this in as well. So, like, we're just Frankensteining Monster Hearts. So, like, let's put a combat system onto Monster Hearts. Screw, screw, screw. All right. Now, shut up, Charles.
Good work with the verbs.
I was making a hand gesture that was not the hand gesture that Charles would be.
I'll include the hand gesture in the podcast.
It was plausible hand gesture.
Whatever. It was no such thing. Yeah, and then you could
maybe
also...
Maybe you just sex wrong.
Hey, now.
Don't blame me for the paucity of your, like, erotic imagination.
I am trying to talk about something else, and I'm going to continue.
Sorry.
Jesus Christ. You could also just pop a Murder of Mr. Crow in there. The Heart of Mr. Crow. The Monster of Mr. Crow. I don't know.
Monster of Mr. Hearts.
I think especially given that this game only takes an hour, it would be a really interesting way to wrap up at the end of a session of an ongoing campaign where the characters had encountered a murder mystery and gathered some clues, and then you could step back and let them take over and interrogate some suspects and finish things off.
And design your world in Microscoper Kingdom, play your world in D&D or Pathfinder, whatever, have your mystery in The Murder of Mr. Crow, all of the games!
And what we're really looking for is eventually a system in which you can read your entire life in a sequence of nested gamified systems.
Oh, I've already done that. That's what I'm playing now.
Oh, fair enough. And here, once again, let us look in the direction of Brave Sparrow. One day.
Have we explained the Brave Sparrow running joke to you? It's okay.
Oh, shit, we need to do that.
Yeah, here's the real brief version.
Don't worry, our listeners don't know it either.
Okay. Yeah, that's all right. And now they might learn. And now that we have an audience here to talk right. directly at.
Let us induct you into our secrets.
All right.
The Cult of the Brave Sparrow. Brave Sparrow was a game that perfectly straddles the line between role-playing game and alternative lifestyle choice. And we do mean fairly far alternative, because like a game alternative lifestyle choice and self-help book is probably about where it's at. You need to believe strongly throughout your day every so often that though you are not a bird person, you might well have been once, and definitely your wings were taken from you, and you will reclaim those wings by keeping an eye open for feathers on the ground, which you will adopt and make part of your wings.
But only if they're worthy.
Only if they're worthy. And also by committing acts of bravery to show your true brave sparrow heart. And if you ever run into another person playing this game, the other person playing this game in the world, you can form flocks together and go on adventures. And if this sounds, again, like it really does straddle the line between a game and a make-believe and someone just telling you about their, like, otherkin identity, it's not entirely clear what the epistemic status of that thing's supposed to be.
You're making a face, Hugh, but, like, we can talk about this at great length later. I made a face at first, but I am converted. I think the Brave Sparrow was beautiful.
There are ways that it speaks to me more than I expected it to.
Yeah, no, at first I was just like, psh, what is this? But then it, like, percolated in my head for months, and now I'm like, oh.
See, I see a certain appeal to it. It has elements of the sort of weird, colorful way that kids walk through the world and incorporate minor details of everyday life into a much more complicated fantasy world. But on the other hand, that's weird.
Tune in next episode for Brave Sparrow Hugh.
For me, it is all about, like, the fact that the game looks you dead in the eye and says, believe this fake thing. Just believe it. And the more I've thought about that, the more I feel like...
I think you're just pro-believe this fake thing as a rule for a game.
I know, I really totally am, though. I think it's lovely.
So we're probably at the end of Necessary Primes, unless we have anything else. Like, consider the Reservoir Dogs generator, consider the wackiness generator, consider the grafting this into your RPGs as a method of having a mystery plot go on generator.
Consider taking out murder and replacing it with something that you like better or that is more fun for you.
The hugging of Mr. Crow.
Who hugged that man?
The elopement of Mr. Crow.
I like the elopement of Mr.
Crow.
I think that's a decent
great.
Yeah. Romance option.
The ascension of Mr. Crow.
I think the ascension of Mr. Crow just sounds like a actual Lovecraft story title.
I think that's less Lovecraft and more Philip K. Dick.
I think that is less Lovecraft and more Philip K. Dick, now that you mention it.
Like Dick.
Who is this game for or not for?
Well,
you like crime TV shows, I guess. Yeah. Like everyone here, I think.
Yeah, I don't see you don't watch them at all.
Or Psych, Monk, SVU. No. Good. This game is for the best. Okay.
This game is definitely for people who are into classic mystery television and novels.
Definitely.
Are you a person who is watching a lot of like low-rated British crime shows on Netflix?
Right. Agatha Christie's Poirot. It's pretty good.
If you're down,
no, I was in the presence.
it is actually garbage, but I watch it anyway.
If you're a down and you're like gumshoe and you want to win for once.
oh, that's bad.
Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries.
That's the one I hear.
It.
Yeah.
It's actually not bad.
I've heard great things. It's actually not bad. It's actually amazing.
Okay.
I think
not as a crime show exactly, but just as a television show.
Okay. If you're looking for some sort of role playing game that you can play at parties, like A Penny for My Thoughts before it. I think this one is probably even better.
It's worth noting that the creator describes this as a parlor game.
Fair enough.
I think it totally can be, absolutely.
The games that we've compared this to, especially Fiasco and A Penny for My Thoughts, I think they're both better than this. I think I like them both better than this, but this game is A, certainly free, B, certainly, you know, 2 pages long, and C, only 1 hour long. So even if you play it and you hate it, it's barely a waste of your time. Like, I've said that in other games, but those ones, at least, you have to buy, you have to take time to learn, and this one almost has none of that, especially now that we spent, like, 1 hour explaining it to you.
I think I'd disagree with Bram and go so far as to say that this game is better than at least Fiasco. If you think of it as a system for generating time, person hours of fun, I think this generates more consistent person hours of enjoyment with less effort and certainly less money than many other games.
But would you agree that the peaks of Fiasco are probably higher? Or no, if you were a perfect playgroup, you could play this as highly as you could play Fiasco?
I think you're right about Fiasco, but I would play this game with my parents.
That's really true.
You could play this game with anyone.
You could take this.
You don't even need to say the words role-playing game.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've played it and approached it like it is.
Yeah.
But this is a game that you could play with anyone who has, you know, even a passing knowledge of the subject matter or has seen the movie Clue. And it wouldn't take that long, and it would be pretty amusing.
And they wouldn't be that good at it, though. We talked about this. Like, one of the difficulties is that it tells you how to play it, but not necessarily how to play it well. And if you take it into those places, I think you're going to get the people who know how to play it, because it's real easy to learn. It's so easy to learn. But I do think it's possible to miss the finer points of how to get a truly satisfying narrative out of it.
I suspect, like, the average game of this played with the average person is more fun than the average game of Fiasco played with the average person.
Okay.
We've played this twice now, and I've had a fine time both times. Like, I laughed a lot. It was pretty funny. It had its good points. I don't know if I would actively, like, go to play this again. I mean, like, Hugh commented before, he'd happily play this, you know, another two times. And I can see why that would be, but I'm not sure if this is an experience that I actually seek out again. Whereas I think I would probably definitely play both Fiasco and A Penny for My Thoughts again.
I will take this game home to my family, I think.
Fair enough. And just to be clear, I think I end up closer to your review than Bram's. I do think that its simplicity, its lightness of weight, and its propensity to generate the sort of thing that it's looking for pretty easily are really strong selling points for a go-anywhere, do-it-with-anyone kind of game. I want to preserve a slight skepticism about how well it will do in low-skill environments.
I agree, but I don't think you lose much by trying.
I think you lose an hour. Like, that's... How badly can you review something that takes this little of your time? And I guess, like, it's possible to... Maybe people are just unkind to movie reviews. We can be unkind to games that are short, too. But, like, it just feels so hard to be mean to it. They're like, do it because you had some time once.
I mean, one of the things that makes it hard to criticize about this game, I think, is that the fact that it is an hour long is a strength of its design.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to be like, well... I'm so mad at this game that is fundamentally really very well designed.
It's not an hour long and it feels too short either, regardless of my Prime version. It's an hour long and fills that hour and does what it's trying to do in an hour and leaves you feeling reasonably satisfied about the whole experience.
I mentioned a different game earlier, Puppetland, which is a much older game. The sessions of it are always exactly an hour long because the rules say they are, because the rules are like, yeah, you have to set a timer, and after an hour, your session is done, nothing more. And I have not played Puppetland yet. We might yet cover it for this podcast, but that feels potentially pretty unnatural to me. Where this promised an hour, and even though we often kind of go along on these games that we play, partially because we're learning the rules, partially because we're doofs, it stuck to an hour, and that is admirable, and like, again, I do recommend this game.
Yeah. The last thing that I feel the need to say is I want to reiterate a thing I said earlier. This game is an absolute triumph in start as close to the end of the story as you can. If we're not reading about the most important point in your character's life, why aren't we reading about that point? Like, this is the most that you can compress this that I can conceive of, and I'm surprised by how well that works, how much it gets what you want out of it. And I think that for that reason, if for no other, that it should be played by anyone with remotely an interest in this kind of plot.
Don't worry, I will definitely give a link to the site in the notes if you couldn't figure out how to spell it from my, I'm sure, bot's pronunciation. Urvek Spell.
Do we have any thoughts about who this game is definitely not for? Or who we would not suggest it to?
It's the miniatures combat people again, yeah. Who are just never
always,
our friends on
always,
this podcast.
Always.
Sorry, everyone.
Go play Neon Sanctum.
Yeah, we're sorry we reviewed Neon Sanctum, anyone who's ever wanted to listen to us, because if you cared about miniatures, you weren't listening by the time we got to it. Now, so those people, as always, are out in the cold, and they can just go play, like, meticulously recreated versions of the Battle of the Somme.
I'd take that a little further and say anyone who's looking to feel like they particularly accomplished something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have nary a day where I feel like that, so I'm clearly pretty much in the audience, but what do you mean?
I mean, anyone who's trying to get a specific sense of achievement or overcoming an obstacle out of playing a tabletop game.
Oh, I think that's pretty fine grain. I think you're right, yeah.
This is not a game that puts you against a challenge. Yeah. It is very much a collaborative game. It's as much a genuinely collaborative game as any I've ever played, and it's absolutely not for someone who plays tabletop games for pitting themselves against a challenge.
Yeah.
It's also not totally for somebody looking to tell a beautiful and cohesive story. If you're here for the story, I think you can probably be here for this game. But on the days when you just really want to tell something that is, like, well-knit and has cool and, like, multifaceted characters and so on and so forth, that's not the day on which you should play The Murder of Mr. Crow.
Yeah, and that's...
I think you could pull it off. You'd have to be skilled and lucky, and all of your other players would have to be on the same page. This is not a game where it'll particularly get to be any character's cool story. At the extreme end, you might not get to be that character the two times they talk. You might get to be them once and then never see them again, and someone else will describe them however they feel like. At the more moderate end, there's a high chance that your character may just be a murderer, and they may have committed that murderer in a way that you would never have written for them and never have intended. Like, I think character player identification is at a pretty low ebb in this.
Yeah, as Bram said, on that day, play Dolls instead.
Yeah. On that day, play Dolls.
Oh, this game is definitely for you. If you want to just look up cute animals while you're playing a game.
Oh, yeah.
Because you can just choose obscure and cute animals.
This game is not for you if you hate cute animals.
Or it is, because the cute animals get to be murderers, and you're like, ha ha ha, fuck you, least weasel.
Yeah, that is a thing that we probably don't need to address, but which we also didn't, which is the way in which having the names be compulsorily species in the rules makes you constantly wonder, are we playing a funny animal game? Are we furs?
And this is why I think dropping the funny that is actually a meaningful modification to the game that would change the way it plays.
It was fun.
I enjoyed so much. I enjoyed so much thinking of our characters as anthro-animals. I enjoyed that tremendously.
But it turns out that if that was not a selling point for you, removing it might bring it closer to the game.
So I settled on the point where they're all people who look, like, somewhat hilariously like those animals.
Yeah.
Like, Dr. Badger is short and has streaks in his hair. And
is blind without his glasses. Yeah.
And has a sort of pointy nose. And
I like
how Madame Fox is tall and has long silver hair. And
yeah.
I like how Shannon spoke up once during this podcast to be in defense of the animals.
I really like the animal names. I could name animals all day. I would be happy. That's my take on the game. Thank you.
All right.
And with that, we're done. Good night.
Animal names plus, murder minus. We at the Parallel Lives office are taking a strong stance on murder.
Don't do it.
Yeah, strong negative stance, sorry.
Yes, you heard right. This is the last episode of Parallel Lives. The last one, for now, that is. While we're still ironing out some of the details, this will mark the start of an extended pause while we transition from a post-whenever-we-happen-to-get-together update schedule to a more seasonal model of podcast, where we'll be able to give you a generally better and more reliable listening experience. In the meanwhile, though, I'll be working on keeping the Parallel Lives website at parallelurl.com and the Twitter at Parallel Chat active, and you can always contact us there or at our email at parallelpodcast@gmail.com, where we'd love to hear letters, comments, or your own play reports for any of the games that we've covered for the show. And hey, an iTunes review never hurt either. Additionally, if you'd like to follow any of us individually, you can find Hugh at dwarfcube.com, Shannon at tyrannosaurus-vex.tumblr.com, Olivia and Charles at genderfight.tumblr.com, and myself at WednesdayQuest on Twitter, where I'd love to hear from you. Please be well, dear listeners. I'm sure that Parallel Live 2nd Edition is going to be killer.
Each player gets a note card or something similar, and they write their name on it and their pick for the guilty suspect. Those are all drawn in. Those are all drawn into the amps, and this one is picked.
Okay, Charles.
I'm having a stroke. Okay, it's not all right.